The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present Mark Weber's World Watch. Mark Weber is director of the Institute for Historical Review, an independent think tank and publishing center. Visit them at ihr.org. And now, here's your host, Mark Weber.
Hello. Whenever a country goes to war, its political leaders always portray the conflict as necessary and morally righteous. But all too often, the emphatic justifications given at the outset of war later turn out to be untrue. For example, most thoughtful Americans now agree that the arguments and pretexts given by the president and other political leaders in the 1960s for deploying combat troops in Vietnam and for large-scale bombing of that country were deceitful and untrue. And nearly everyone now accepts that the reasons given by the White House, high-level officials of both major parties, and much of the media for invading and occupying Iraq in 2003 were likewise untrue. But whatever doubts or misgivings Americans may have about their country's role in Vietnam, Iraq, or other overseas conflicts, most accept that the sacrifices made by the U.S. in World War II, especially in defeating Hitler's Germany, were entirely justified and worthwhile. This global clash with the United States and the other allies on one side, and Germany, Japan, and the other Axis countries on the other, is routinely portrayed in the U.S. as the good war, a morally clear-cut conflict between good and evil. Americans are also told that this was an unavoidable and necessary war, one that the U.S. had to wage to keep from being enslaved by cruel and ruthless dictators. For more than 60 years, this view has been reinforced in countless motion pictures, on television, in classrooms, and by political leaders. How accurate is this familiar portrayal? Over the years, a number of historians, including Harry Elmer Barnes in the United States and A.J.P. Taylor in Britain, have presented impressive evidence refuting the conventional view. I have also contributed to this effort, most recently in a lengthy piece entitled The Good War Myth of World War II, which is posted on the IHR website. Today I'll be speaking about two books published last year that challenge the familiar but simplistic portrayal. These two books are Human Smoke by Nicholson Baker and Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War by Patrick J. Buchanan. The author of the first book, Nicholson Baker, is an acclaimed American writer with a pacifist and humanitarian outlook who admires the principled men and women who courageously spoke out against war. The other writer, Patrick Buchanan, is a prominent conservative author and commentator who is well known for his loyalty to and unapologetic defense of the legacy, traditions, and values of Western civilization. By the way, Buchanan's book is available for sale from the IHR. Buchanan begins his book with these sobering words. All about us, we can see clearly now that the West is passing away. He goes on to explain that his goal in writing this book is to show how the great global catastrophes of the First and Second World Wars, which shattered the power and confidence of Western man, could have been avoided. There are two great myths about these wars, writes Buchanan. The first is that World War I was fought to make the world safe for democracy. The second is that World War II was the good war, a glorious crusade to rid the world of fascism that turned out wonderfully well. The books by Baker and Buchanan are all the more compelling and worthy of consideration because the two writers have very different political or ideological views, and yet have some remarkably similar things to say about the origins and course of World War II. The fact that these nonconformist books were issued by major American publishers and have earned respectful reviews shows, I think, that more people are now willing to take a skeptical look at the conventional, politically correct narrative of World War II. Both Baker and Buchanan are fierce critics of Winston Churchill. They highlight the British leader's passion for war, his ruthlessness, and his brutality. They present facts, quotations, and anecdotes that offset the flattering, reverential portrayal of Churchill that has been promoted for years in our media and by so many of our politicians. Buchanan writes, "There has arisen among America's elite a Churchill cult. Its acolytes hold that Churchill was not only a peerless war leader, but a statesman of unparalleled vision. In fact," says Buchanan, "it was Churchill's wars that brought Britain and his beloved empire to ruin." He goes on, "For it was Winston S. Churchill who was the most bellicose champion of British entry into the European War of 1914 and the German-Polish War of 1939. In his first address to the British Parliament as Prime Minister, Churchill declared, "You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. It is victory. Victory at all costs." Buchanan comments, "Churchill was true to his word." He goes on to cite the assessment of British historian Alan Clark, who wrote, quote, "The war went on far too long, and when Britain emerged, the country was bust. Nothing remained of assets overseas. Without immense and punitive borrowings from the U.S., we would have starved. The old social order had gone forever. The empire was terminally damaged. The Commonwealth countries had seen their trust betrayed and their soldiers wasted." Churchill, says Buchanan, had been a great man at the cost of his country's greatness. Both authors quote from a remarkable article by Churchill about the critical Jewish role in Soviet communism, an article that is all the more startling given that throughout his life, he was an ardent supporter of Zionism and Jewish causes. In this piece, published in February 1920, Churchill warns of what he calls the schemes of international Jews. He goes on to write, quote, "This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky in Russia, Bela Kun in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, and impossible equality has been steadily growing." Unquote. This Jewish conspiracy, Churchill went on, had been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century. He also wrote, "This band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire." Both Baker and Buchanan show that during the 1930s, Hitler and Third Reich Germany were viewed very differently than they are today. Not only in Europe, but around the world, millions were impressed by the prosperity, cultural rebirth, national cohesion, and dynamic sense of purpose that Hitler and his National Socialist government had brought to a once economically ruined, humiliated, and socially divided nation. Taking note of what he calls Hitler's economic achievements, Buchanan writes, "Before the end of his fourth year in power, Hitler had ended the Depression, cut unemployment from 6 million to 1 million, grown Germany's GNP by 37%, and increased auto production from 45,000 vehicles a year to 250,000. City and provincial deficits had disappeared." David Lloyd George, who was Britain's prime minister during World War I, visited Germany in 1936. After meeting with Hitler, the British statesman spoke highly of the German leader. "He is indeed a great man," said Lloyd George, who went on to compare Hitler's book Mein Kampf to the Magna Carta. In an interview with a London newspaper after his return home, Lloyd George said, "Hitler has done great things for his country. He is unquestionably a great leader, a dynamic personality." Even Winston Churchill had some favorable things to say about the German leader in those years. In a 1935 essay, Churchill wrote of his, quote, "admiration for the courage, the perseverance, and the vital force which enabled Hitler to challenge, defy, conciliate, or overcome all the authorities or resistance which barred his path." In a book published in 1937, Churchill wrote, "Those who have met Herr Hitler face to face in public business or on social terms have found a highly competent, cool, well-informed functionary with an agreeable manner, a disarming smile, and few have been unaffected by a subtle personal magnetism." In September 1937, Churchill wrote, "One may dislike Hitler's system and yet admire his patriotic achievement. If our country were defeated, I hope we should find a champion as indomitable to restore our courage and lead us back to our place among the nations." Buchanan devotes quite a lot of attention to the British pledge of military support to Poland in March 1939, which stiffened the staunch refusal by Poland's leaders to peacefully settle with Germany the issue of freedom and self-determination for the Germans of Danzig and the so-called Corridor. As he notes, the fateful British guarantee ultimately proved worthless. Buchanan writes that British Prime Minister Chamberlain had known all along his guarantee was worthless. He had confided as much to the U.S. Ambassador to London, Joe Kennedy, who wrote in his diary, "Churchill says the futility of it all is the thing that is frightful. After all, they, the British and French, cannot save the Poles. They can merely carry on a war of revenge that will mean the destruction of the whole of Europe." It was this British pledge and Britain's declaration of war against Germany in September 1939 that transformed the limited German-Polish conflict into a European-wide war.
Don't go away, because there's more on Mark Weber's World Watch. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com.
Thanks to the cooperation of students and staff at St. Francis Preparatory School in Fresh Meadow, Queens, we do, however, have a much firmer grasp now of the situation at that school. Most of the students and staff at the school have filled out health questionnaires, and we now know of hundreds of students who were sick. Many family members of these students and staff are also sick. We would normally expect to see one out of every five family members of a person with flu get sick, and that is exactly what we're seeing with swine flu. And very reassuringly, all of the cases have been mild, both in students and in staff. So let me just repeat that this has been following the pattern of normal seasonal influenza. Nothing worse so far. At this point, we have 44 confirmed cases of swine flu in New York City. We have also discovered 5 new probable cases of swine flu in the city. One of them is related to the cases at St. Francis. 2 of them are still under investigation. And of the remaining 2, one is a 2-year-old boy in the Bronx who is currently in the hospital, however, is recovering. And the boy has an older brother who also exhibited flu symptoms, but tests for swine flu are not complete, and the child is feeling better.
Let's return to Mark Weber's World Watch, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now, here is your host, Mark Weber.
For years, Americans have been told that, however terrible the cost in death, misery, and destruction, the war against Hitler was necessary and unavoidable because he was out to conquer the world. Both Baker and Buchanan persuasively refute this familiar claim. Buchanan, in particular, piles fact on fact to dispose of the myth that Hitler wanted war against Britain or France, or that Hitler's Germany was a mortal threat to America. For example, Buchanan quotes the German leader's words to the League of Nations High Commissioner, who was trying to arrange a peaceful resolution of the German-Polish crisis just 3 weeks before the German attack against Poland. Hitler said, "Everything that I undertake is directed against Russia. If the West is too stupid and too blind to understand this, then I will be forced to reach an understanding with the Russians, smash the West, and then turn all my concentrated strength against the Soviet Union. I need the Ukraine so that no one can starve us out again as in the last war." In fact, the claim that Hitler wanted to conquer the world is a good example of a big lie, a brazen falsehood, repeated so often and so loudly that millions of people accept it as true. Baker and Buchanan show that it was the British government, not Hitler's Germany, that initiated a policy of mass civilian death and destruction, including systematic bombing of civilians. Already in 1939, Baker notes, Britain's Minister of Economic Warfare, Sir Frederick Leith Ross, was in charge of setting a policy of mass starvation of the German population. American journalist Edward R. Murrow said at the time, "It is his job to starve Germany by any known means, all of them, men, women, and children." In 1940, British military chiefs drew up plans for starving millions of Germans. A British government report noted that, although this policy might raise moral questions, it was necessary because, quote, "it is only by this pressure that we can ensure the defeat of Germany." Churchill, in a memo that same year to his Minister of Aircraft Production, expressed support for what he called an absolutely devastating, exterminating attack by very heavy bombers from this country upon the Nazi homeland. Hitler, for his part, held off civilian bombing of England in spite of British bomber attacks against German civilians. And after a public appeal by Hitler to bring the war to an end, Churchill responded with new British bombing attacks on German cities. In July of 1944, Churchill wrote to General Ismay of his Chief of Staff's committee, quote, "I want you to think seriously over this question of poison gas. We could drench the cities of the Ruhr and many other cities in Germany in such a way that most of the population would be requiring constant medical attention. If we do it, let us do it 100%. In the meantime, I want the matter studied in cold blood by sensible people and not by that particular set of psalm-singing uniformed defeatists." And Churchill told his Royal Air Force planners, quote, "It is absurd to consider morality on this topic." Both Baker and Buchanan take seriously Hitler's numerous proposals for peace. They cite, for example, the German leader's major address in October 1939, in which he warned that if the pro-war Churchill faction prevailed in Britain, the result would be a devastating large-scale war that would be a catastrophe for everyone. In this speech, Hitler said, "In the course of history, there have never been two victors, but very often only losers." Baker and Buchanan also discuss and take seriously Germany's peace initiatives after the fall of France. Each author cites Hitler's historic address in Berlin on July 19, 1940, in which the German leader appealed to Britain to bring the fighting to an end, in spite of Churchill's adamant rejection of any talk of peace. Prophetically, Hitler said, "A great world empire will be destroyed, a world empire which it was never my intention or to destroy or damage." He also said, "I am fully aware that the continuation of this war will only end with the complete destruction of one of the two warring parties. I see no reason that should compel us to continue this war." Baker reviews Hitler's steadily harsher measures against Jews. As Baker makes clear, these were not in accord with any master plan, but rather taken step by step as part of a general escalation of violence and brutality by both sides. The increasingly harsher measures against Jews, Baker shows, were in response to, or at least in step with, increasingly brutal measures against Germans by Germany's enemies. When the war broke out in 1939, Baker makes clear, Hitler had no plan or intention to exterminate Jews and certainly no genocidal plan or program prior to November-December 1941. And Buchanan emphasizes that without Britain's blank check guarantee to Poland and its declaration of war against Germany in 1939, that is, without the conflict we call World War II, there would not have been the catastrophe for Europe's Jews that is now known as the Holocaust. Both Baker and Buchanan write about the Atlantic Charter, a declaration of war aims issued in 1941 by Prime Minister Churchill and President Franklin Roosevelt. In this much-publicized statement, the leaders of Britain and the United States solemnly declared that they sought no territorial changes that do not accord with the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned, and that they would respect the right of all peoples to choose the form of government under which they will live, and that they would strive to see sovereign rights and self-government restored to those who have been forcibly deprived of them. It soon became apparent, though, that this solemn pledge of freedom and self-government for all peoples was little more than empty propaganda designed to impress and deceive the masses, especially in the United States. A major theme of Buchanan's book is the danger of what he calls the Churchill cult. For the supporters of this cult, he writes, defiance anywhere of U.S. hegemony, resistance anywhere to U.S. power, becomes another 1938. Every adversary, a new Hitler. Every proposal to avert war, another Munich. He adds, "This Churchill cult gives us our present calamity. If not exposed, it will produce more wars and more disasters, and one day a war of the magnitude of Churchill's wars that brought Britain and his beloved empire to ruin." Expanding on this theme, Buchanan warns against policy driven by what he calls democratic fundamentalism. He notes that President George W. Bush, an admirer of Churchill, sent American armed forces to war in accord with, quote, "a Wilsonian ideology of democratic fundamentalism. Only by making the whole world democratic can we make America secure." Since the 1940s and 1950s, there has been a drastic rewriting of American and world history, including a major shift in how we are supposed to look at World War II. reflecting the important Jewish role in our cultural and political life and the special status in our culture of Jewish concerns and sensibilities. A central feature in the way that World War II is now portrayed in our classrooms, in the mass media, and by our politicians is an emphasis on Jewish death and suffering in the war, the Holocaust. In fact, it was not until the late 1970s and early 1980s that the Holocaust began to appear as a specific entry in standard encyclopedias and reference books and become an obligatory subject in American textbooks and classrooms. Michael Barenbaum, one-time research director of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and a Georgetown University theology professor, has candidly acknowledged this rewriting of history. Barenbaum said, quote, "The Holocaust was once regarded as a side story of the much larger story of World War II. Now one thinks of World War II as a background story and the Holocaust as a foreground story." Along with the portrayal of the wartime murder and suffering of Europe's Jews as the greatest crime in history, Hitler's Germany is relentlessly portrayed as the most vile and evil regime in history, one that all decent and right-thinking people are obliged to hate. In assessing the legacy of World War II, one thing that can now be said with certainty is that it was not a victory for European culture or Western civilization. That's entirely understandable because the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union, the main victors in the war, openly proclaimed their intention of creating a new world order based on egalitarian universalist principles. European cities are filling with people from Southern Asia, Northern and Western Africa, and other third world regions. This was predictable and inevitable, given that since the end of World War II, in Western Europe and in the United States, the prevailing ideology has been universalist and egalitarian, and the social political system has been liberal democratic. Because the Second World War has been so important in shaping our world, the revisionist books by Nicholson Baker and Patrick Buchanan are valuable antidotes to simplistic, politically correct history and important contributions to a more reasoned and objective understanding of our age and ourselves. Thanks for being with me today. I hope you'll join me for the next World Watch broadcast. To learn more about the Institute for Historical Review and our work, please check out our website, ihr.org.
Thanks for listening. Mark Weber's World Watch returns Tuesday evening, 9 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.